The macroeconomic phrase of the day this Wednesday, substantial underlying economic momentum, thus saith the Fed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, 21 February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. With the caveat that, yes, this is to some degree retrospective economic Kremlinology, we begin today with what the Federal Reserve was thinking at its last meeting, the minutes of which were released this afternoon. The short answer is, as I said in the open, the central bank thinks there is some substantial underlying economic momentum going on out there. Also, that the initial bump the economy is going to get from the tax cuts might be bigger than originally expected. Probably three interest rate increases this year, if keeping track. The White House, meanwhile, offered its own official economic prognosis today, the annual economic report of the president, President Trump's first, and it agrees with the Fed. Economic growth is going to be just fine, the administration says, 3% or more, in part because the White House is assuming worker productivity is going to grow as well. Of course, regular listeners to this broadcast know the big economic bugaboo for years and years now has been that worker productivity has been basically flat. And if workers aren't producing more, it is tough for an economy to grow. The McKinsey Global Institute is out with a new report today, though, saying the era of low productivity growth might finally be coming to an end. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on explainer duty.
So a friend recently sent me a recipe for a blood orange olive oil cake that's delicious, but a ton of work. You have to cut each little section of blood orange out of its membrane. The first time I made it, it took forever, ages. But the second time, I was a little faster, more efficient. Eileen Applebaum, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says there are a couple ways bakers or other workers can become more productive.
Either that they become more skilled or that their employer invests in technology and equipment and that helps them be more efficient.
Some kind of separating machine would make that recipe a breeze, meaning if I sold my delicious cakes, I could make more of them, sell more, make more money, have more money to spend. Voila, economic growth.
If productivity is increasing, then our ability to grow the economic pie is increasing.
To mix baking metaphors, problem is productivity growth has been slow for a while now. James Manica, chairman of the McKinsey Global Institute, says one reason is that after the financial crisis, companies didn't want to invest in new machines or software that might improve worker productivity because they didn't know what the future held or if customers would buy their products. That uncertainty is finally letting up. And he thinks a new wave of technological change is coming. Everything from self-checkout kiosks in stores to remote monitoring of electric meters.
We're seeing digital technologies everywhere, but they've yet to quite fully pay off in terms of transforming the economy.
Manica says the U.S. economy has only realized about 20% of its potential digitization. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Speaking of that digital economy, social media companies are increasingly finding themselves in the crosshairs of the national debate. And you get the sense it's a little bit painful for them. There was much conservative outrage on Twitter today after the company suspended what was said to be thousands of bot accounts, mostly anonymous trolls. Twitter, we should say here, says it is apolitical in which accounts it suspends. Selena Wang covers technology for Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We should say, first of all, this is not the first time that Twitter has tried to shut down various and sundry bots, right?
No, not at all. This is something that they've struggled with over the years, ever since its inception, really. I mean, Twitter as a company has encouraged anonymity in various forms, as well as automated accounts. Now, many of them are innocuous. They allow companies to spread their messages or respond to customer service complaints. The issue is that more recently, more and more, we're seeing them being used for nefarious or malicious purposes, whether that's for harassing women or even election meddling.
Is this, though, do you think, sort of an effective way to do it? I mean, you can go out every, you know, 2 months or a week and a half or whatever it is and disable 1,000 accounts, or you can get a more systemic approach. What's your sense of what Twitter is thinking?
Absolutely. The minute that Twitter figures out how a network of bots or automated accounts are acting, they will try to then target that pattern. But then the moment they do that, these networks will change their strategies again. It's very much a whack-a-mole problem. I've spoken to many people inside Twitter. Even if they have a 99% catch rate, even a tiny fraction margin of error means that a lot of malicious accounts will still go through.
You know, I read a great thing the other day talking about how it's basically these companies' business models to get as big as possible. Certainly Facebook with a couple of billion users and Twitter would love to get there. So they have to have scale for their business model. But at the same time, their solution to this abuse and bot problem seems to be, well, if we can get a couple of people on it, it'll be taken care of. And that doesn't seem to match.
It's certainly a multifaceted issue. On the one hand, as you mentioned, Wall Street and pressure from investors does not make this an easy problem for them to solve. When you look at Twitter, the main metric Wall Street cares about is this number called monthly active users. They want to grow that number as much as possible. As they combat this issue, it will cause an impact, at least in the short term, on this monthly active user number. But the thinking is that if they're able to make it a healthier, safer, cleaner platform in the long run, it will attract more users to the platform who may have been turned off by it in the first place because of the proliferation of abuse and hate on it.
How come it's right-wing bots that get all the attention? Does the left just not understand the bot technology? I mean, it's a little bit like talk radio, right? You got right-wing talk radio and not a whole lot on the left.
Well, if we just look at the issue today, we saw a lot of right-wing conservatives complain that their accounts were being locked or that they were losing follower counts. What we don't know is if a similar distribution of left-wing folks and just influential figures in general were similarly affected by this problem. But we do know that the conservative voices may have an outsized influence on the type of coverage on Twitter. And so it's not clear, though, if this is just a right-wing problem.
Right. Ought to say here, just for the record, there's no First Amendment right to a Twitter account. So, you know. Right. Selina Wang at Bloomberg News talking about Twitter and bots and all that stuff that's in the news today. Selina, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Wall Street today was a little bit conflicted, loved what the Fed had to say, and then decided maybe it didn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going back one more time to Erie, Pennsylvania today, a city and a county we've spent a whole lot of time in the past year or so trying to get a sense of what people had hoped for and what they think they got with the election of Donald Trump. Erie, as you know, was built on manufacturing, but a lot of those manufacturing companies and the jobs they offered have up and left. And that has left a lot of people in Erie feeling left behind, which is how we found ourselves back in the Polish Falcons Social Club, Nest 610. It's a neighborhood gathering spot. People come after work for a beer or a couple. First time we came was last January, right before the inauguration.
The hardest thing to find in Erie is a job.
We need a lot of jobs, good jobs, because GE was the only one left. I worked in shops all my life.
If you're going into medicine, yeah, it might be a good place. As for manufacturing, it's dead.
That's a big problem around here is factories closing or partially closing.
We went back a couple of weeks ago.
What's going on?
We spoke last time. I'm almost positive. Do you remember talking to me?
I remember you.
Yeah. Remind me what your name is?
My name is Fred Dash.
Fred and his wife Nancy are regulars, both retired, living, they say, on about $3,000 a month.
Erie is pretty much poverty-stricken. Sorry. There is not a lot of good-paying jobs. I have grandsons. I have grandchildren. They can't find a decent job here. One just started working at a dog training place. Started today.
How much is he going to make, do you know?
Probably nothing.
So what do you think is the future of this city?
Seriously. I think it sucks. I think it's done. I really do. I don't think Erie is going to go too far.
What do you think of the future of this country? Of the businesses and of the companies and of the people that make things in this economy. What's your guess as to how that's going to go?
I think they're all going to make it. I think they know now how to make the country better, and they are going to make it better.
Did you vote for Mr. Trump?
I can't really honestly tell you that.
How are you feeling about how he's doing?
I think he's great.
You're happy with it?
I think so. My husband is.
Mr. Trump left a billionaire lifestyle because he's an American and loves this country. That's how I look at it.
Nancy Dash's husband, Fred.
And you have these idiots like Pelosi. They're idiots. What's wrong with them? They can't accept that they lost the election.
You think that's what it's still all about?
Absolutely.
Are you better off today than you were a year ago?
Because of Trump, yes.
So you like what Mr. Trump is doing on the economy and
absolutely.
The tax bill
absolutely.
And yeah, right. regulations,
absolutely.
All of that?
Absolutely.
For years, GE Transportation was Erie's big economic driver. But 2 years ago, the company cut 1,500 jobs. There are plans for another almost 600 job cuts this year. Now most of the well-paying jobs in town are at the hospital or the university or the insurance company, the kinds of jobs that don't necessarily match up with the skills a lot of the longtime locals have. Bob, who you're about to hear here, is 62 years old. He asked us not to use his last name. He's worked on the assembly line at General Electric for 14 years, makes just over $70,000 a year.
That's good. That's good in Erie, yes.
So you have a couple of cars in the house and...
A couple old cars, yeah. My newest car is a 2011. I don't dare go buy a new car.
He's worried, he says, about all the jobs he has seen cut at GE. But there is more than just that.
I am very angry. I'm very angry. Very angry what's happening to this country. Coming to the end of my working life and to see this happening and watching the younger guys I work with, they're going to have to struggle for 20 years. They don't know from month to month what's going to happen. And you should go to work and should be able to know that you have a job, that you can make your house payments or whatever, send your kids to school. That's just the uncertainty of everything now. The American people better wake up if they haven't. We're done. I believe we're done as a country.
So are you just getting up in the morning and putting in your time at GE?
I get up in the morning and I put on the news to see if we're at war. Every morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. Then I check the weather.
Johnette Kent has lived in Erie her whole life. She's 66 now, recently retired from the State Department of Public Welfare.
Are we better off? No. You can promise everybody roads. You can promise them housing. You can promise them jobs. You're going to start just printing money? Where is this going to come from? With Donald Trump, it's smoke and mirrors.
Here's a question, though, right? I mean, the economy is growing. Jobs are being added. Consumers are extremely confident. They're spending money.
Let me ask you this. Now, how many jobs, when they say jobs are added, does that balance the jobs lost? I'm not sure they are. Lower-paying jobs are being added instead of the manufacturing jobs that paid a decent living.
Here's the other part of the economic equation. There's a big tax cut law that just went into effect, mm-hmm. right? People are going to start seeing money in their paychecks. Businesses are happy because regulations are being cut. You're not having that?
It'll all come home to roost. When the company's bankrupt, who's going to pay the bills then? People were eating bread. Suddenly you're giving them cake. It may look good, but again, it's all smoke and mirrors. The money for revitalization of the infrastructure has to come from somewhere. The way the government gets money is taxation. Come on.
What was interesting about that night at the Polish Falcon was that there was a kind of divide, an economic generational divide between who was feeling all right and who wasn't. Sitting at a table at the back of the bar was a group of five. Elspeth Keeley was one of them. She's 41, works as an organizer for Erie County United.
I'm doing much better this year than I was last year. And I think it's a bit of a reaction to recent events.
The organizing business is good.
Right. Yes, it is.
How about your own personal economy? How are you feeling?
I feel good.
Do you?
Yes. I mean, my brothers and sisters in Erie, I don't feel so great about how they're doing. And that's why I'm doing the work I do.
Martha Wachuku does the same kind of work at Erie County United. She's 25.
I graduated college and I got a job. And I think I'm making the natural progression I'm supposed to.
So you're feeling pretty good.
I'm feeling okay, yeah.
What would make it better for you?
If I didn't have student loans to pay.
Can you afford a car and an apartment and all that?
Yeah, but all on loans. I hate having debt. I hate the idea of debt.
So in 5 years, mm-hmm. where do you think you are economically? I mean, if you're doing fine now at 25, not great, but fine.
Yeah.
How are you going to be doing at 30?
Well, I hope to have my student loans paid off. I would love to own my car. And I honestly don't know. I don't know where I will be at 30, but beyond this, I hope.
Are you too optimistic? Not just about Erie, but about your own economic futures? Elizabeth?
Of course we are. I mean, she's 25 years old. I hope she has optimism, because if she doesn't, she's going to have a hard go of it, you know? But yeah, right?
Yeah.
Matt Texter's 39. He's a graphic artist. Originally from Grove City, Pennsylvania, came to Erie looking for some career advancement, and he found it. But his economy in the past year or so?
It's like two paychecks away from being not good, if you include debt and mortgage and things like that. You know, not much of a savings.
Still, though,
I have a lot of hope that it's going to get better. I don't feel like I'm stuck because I like Erie. You know what I mean? I it is affordable, and it's given me a lot. I see a lot of potential in Erie. I mean, it's beautiful. I don't know if you've been here in the summer, but it's a beautiful place to be.
There are other hopeful and optimistic people in Erie, people like Matt and Elspeth and Martha, people who are making economic moves and starting businesses in town. Later in the show, a 30-year-old woman who left her job as an engineer to open up a coffee shop in downtown Erie. Coming up.
People see it as kind of a declining city, but really, you know, I see it as that like heart of a fire.
What a coffee shop can tell you about a city's future. But first, yeah, sure. Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 166 points today, 0.6%, closed at 24,797. Got to tell you, the blue chips were up 300 points at one point today. NASDAQ ended down 16, about 0.2%, 72.18. The S&P 500 off 14 points, about 0.5%, 27.01. Banks got a boost on those Fed minutes we told you about. Citigroup up 0.7%. JPMorgan Chase advanced 0.4%. Today, tech stocks rebounded from a slide earlier this month. Facebook brightened up 1%. Netflix up about 0.8%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.95%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. According to the Census Bureau, black women own about 1.5 million businesses in this economy, doing about $42 billion in sales every year. Tomorrow, hundreds of African-American women are going to meet in Atlanta to figure out how to make the most of that economic power and how to be heard better in business and politics and everything else. From WABE in Atlanta, LEU reports.
Contractors brush a coat of white paint over a wall to put the finishing touches on this empty salon in Atlanta's west side.
It needs more lighting, I agree. And more lighting up here.
Labria Lee Holt bought this one-story brick building last year to open up her passion project, Sweet Roots. She wanted to create a blow-dry bar using all-natural products specifically for women of color.
As an African-American woman or a woman with textured hair, you don't always have trust when you walk into. I can't just walk into any storefront and say, can you blow out my hair or give me a hairstyle, because they may not be familiar.
To Holt, it's also more than just about familiarity. She says when she was researching the market for her business, she didn't see a lot of black women represented in ownership in big salon chains.
It just shows how so much money is spent on this stuff by our community and by women, and none of that money is really going back to our community.
This week, Holt will join hundreds of black women from across the country in downtown Atlanta to talk about ways to change that. The four-day summit, Power Rising, will focus on issues like business and the economy, politics, and health.
We're looking to come out of the conference at the end with an action plan.
D.C. area pastor Leah Daughtry is co-organizer of the conference.
With some things that we can agree that we will do in the coming weeks, the coming months, to move forward our communities and our nation.
Daughtry was CEO of the 2016 Democratic National Convention. She says the idea came out of a retreat for women members of the Congressional Black Caucus after the presidential election. She says black women have time and time again demonstrated the power of their vote, but that hasn't always translated to being represented in politics.
But beyond that, our consumerism, the amount of money that we control in an American economy, the influence that we have on culture and on business, we are not represented in corporate boardrooms in the way that we should be.
According to the University of Georgia's Seelig Center for Economic Growth, African-American buying power will reach $1.5 trillion by 2021, a 25% increase from 2016. And a recent Nielsen report shows that black women are a big part of that growth. They're also one of the fastest-growing groups of entrepreneurs in the country. But Kimberly Blackwell with the National Women's Business Council says despite that, there are disparities.
Black women business owners continue to have annual receipts that are much less than the broader populations. So still a lot of work to be done there.
She says Black women business owners can face certain challenges like getting access to capital or finding a network of mentors. One of LaBria Lee Holt's challenges has been juggling a full-time job while trying to get her business off the ground. She's been using her own money along with a small business loan. At the conference, she'll speak about entrepreneurship.
I would love to see if there's a way to create more support for Black women who may be talented and have brilliant ideas that are just missing, you know, funding or potential funding revenue streams in order to do that.
And if all goes as planned, her salon is set to have its grand opening in May. In Atlanta, I'm Ellie Yu for Marketplace.
Should you find yourself in Erie, Pennsylvania, looking for a good cup of coffee, you've got a couple of choices. You could go to Starbucks. Sure, there's five or six of them in town, if you consider that good coffee. Or you could go to the only non-Starbucks coffee shop inside city limits. It's called Ember and Forge. Hannah Kirby, proprietor. She's 30, originally from Waynesburg, Pennsylvania, came to town first for college in engineering. Later, she got her MBA. She had a good job, too, doing engineer stuff at a manufacturing company in town, but decided she wanted something else.
So I came to Erie in 2006 to go to Gannon University here in downtown Erie. Fell in love with the people that were here. Really just decided, like, this is where I want to stay. I bought a house right out of college here inside the city limits. And it's, you know, kind of just has been my thing to, like, support this city and help it grow and develop. So when I chose it as my home, just made sense for me to, you know, build the business here in Erie. It's Ember and Forge. This building was built in 1851, and it originally was a chandlery. So the chandlery idea is where I kind of came up with the ember, so candles and that kind of whole flame fire aspect. And then the forge part of it comes from Erie's history as a manufacturing town. And then when we started looking at a little bit deeper, you know, we thought about what an ember was. It's the remnants of a once really blazing fire. And we thought that was just so appropriate for where Erie is. We have lost a lot of jobs and people see it as kind of a declining city. But really, you know, I see it as that like heart of a fire that really can be turned into flames so easily. You know, a lot of people say that Erie has a lot of potential, and it most certainly does, but saying that it has potential is it's not totally living up to it. And I think that Erie already is doing a lot. Growth is certainly welcomed, but I think that we have a lot to offer. You know, the younger generation, I feel like, you know, we don't expect to have those jobs that an older generation had. They have never existed for us. So where you come out of high school and, you know, work in a manufacturing job, and that is a wage that you're able to raise a family on. We've never had that opportunity. So we realize that, you know, we have to make those jobs that are family sustaining, life sustaining. People are starting to realize, younger generation specifically, that, you know, we're not going to be able to turn to our federal government. We're not going to be able to turn to our state government to build cities, and that, you know, really the cities are going to have to do it themselves. So it's really becoming more obvious that this is a growing city. You know, I hope that we can just be here for a long time, and what would make this dream like absolutely set in stone would be that two people come in and talk about an idea, come up with a plan inside these walls, and then execute it outside of them that really helps our city grow. That would be kind of the ultimate dream.
That was Hannah Kirby. She's the owner of Ember and Forge Coffee in Erie, PA. All the stories from our series, we call it The Big Promise, live online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, say what you will about Bill Gates, but he's clearly a good sport. He went on Ellen yesterday. Part of the gig was a game where she asked him to guess the prices of various and sundry household goods. I'm just going to roll the tape here.
Oh,
phones.
Okay.
Tide Pods. You've been hearing a lot about those lately. What do you think?
$4. No. They want me to go higher.
Yeah.
Let's go with $10.
All right. $19.97. It's expensive to do laundry.
I mean, the guy never shops, right? Holy cow, we gotta go. Sarah Bruguiere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.